This episode is brought to you by Adobe. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for designing, sharing, and prototyping experiences. Try the free beta today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 39. Today, I had the great privilege of interviewing the author of Psychology for Designers, Mr. Joe, or Joe, now that he's a friend, I can call him that. This was such a fun interview to do. I love how Joe has invested so much energy and time into studying psychology and tying it into design and human-computer interaction. And he's just a wealth of knowledge, and there's so much in here to take away from, especially as it relates to business, studying business, and getting to know that side of things as a designer and the great value and benefit that will come from you and your role if you do that. I just want to take a second to share an iTunes review that came through recently. This one's from Crystal. Crystal said, "Such an inspiring podcast. 5 stars. This podcast has kept me inspired to not give up and to keep going into this field with passion and drive. I've been going about a year into this field, and thanks to Jason, I'm able to keep up with the new trends and learn from other professionals and learning different perspectives. Also, Jason is a really cool guy and takes his time for his listeners. He answered all my emails and was kind enough to Skype with me and answer my questions because I've been feeling stuck for a while on how to move forward in UX and UI, and Jason helped me find the path. Highly recommend this podcast if you're wanting to move up in the field and learn more about it. Plus, it's entertaining to listen to." Crystal, thanks so much. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I'm so happy to hear that it was able to help you navigate this complex and ever-evolving field, as I say. Defenders listening, would you do me a favor and take a minute to leave a rating and review as well? It certainly helps the show so much to kind of give it a little more discoverability and keep it in the ranks, I suppose, when folks are like you are looking for inspiring content to help keep them going. So I appreciate it in advance if you could do that. I may even read it in the future episodes. So the way to do that is to go to userdefenders.com/review. And if you're on your phone, I think I know on iPhone, it'll actually take you right to the tab to where you can do that. So thanks in advance. I really appreciate you. Mr. Joe Leach, Joe to his friends, is a user experience consultant based in Bristol, UK. He's the author of Psychology for Designers. He's a 13-year UX veteran who's worked with organizations like MoMA, Raspberry Pi, Disney, eBay, and Marriott. He's a recovering neuroscientist who spent a spell as an elementary school teacher. He's also the series editor of Aspects of UX, a book series on UX from SitePoint.com. And he once had a sauna with Meatloaf, the rock star, not the food. Welcome to User Defenders, Joe. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be here as well. It's a shame Meatloaf couldn't join us as well, really. I did ask him, but he was unfortunately busy doing something else.
Yeah, so that's interesting. That is an interesting story, Joe. I'm curious though. Did he say that he would do anything for love, but he won't do that?
I wouldn't do that. No. I wish it was kind of an unexpected thing, because it was in my old hometown of Bath in the UK, which is quite a small little city, and not much really happens there. And it's my local swimming pool, and next to the swimming pool is the local rugby ground where they sometimes have, you know, rock concerts in the summer. So people like Simply Red have played, and Genesis, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was doing my usual Friday afternoon after school swim, and I went for a sauna afterwards, and it's always very quiet that time of the day. And I went into the sauna, and there's this sort of this big guy there with this kind of lank hair, and, you know, I'm quite a conversational guy, and it was quite awkward. So I sort of, you know, sat down. I was like, "Hi," and he's like, "Hey, man." And I was like, "Hi." We started chatting, and I said, "So what is it you do?" And he's like, "Dude, I'm Meatloaf." You're like, "Okay, fair enough. I know what you do. You're just Meatloaf." And he was playing a concert in the rugby ground next to the swimming pool, and they didn't have really many facilities for him. So he'd somehow got himself into the public sauna, and it was just me and him in there. So we had a nice chat about what he did and what I did. And yeah, I met Meatloaf in the sauna.
That is so cool. What a cool story, man. So as you know, every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking just a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Okay, sure. So my personal life. So I am a freelance consultant. So what that means is I help organizations just do small, I suppose, quite strategic pieces of work to get stuff done quite quickly. And what that means on a practical level in my personal life is that means I work from home quite a lot, which is quite nice. And also as part of that, me and my wife have just had a little baby and she's 4 months old. So
well, congratulations.
I'm currently juggling. Thank you. Currently juggling consultancy work and holding a baby, which is quite a nice place to be, really. So I have to switch between these two very different modes of working, baby, Skype call, which is, you know.
Have you found the lack of sleep has made you more creative or no?
It's certainly given me an edge in different ways. I think I've certainly, I've noticed myself, whereas before I'd just be very patient with the people I was working with and say, let's talk about your problems. Now I'm a little bit more straight to the point, I'd say, just do this, just get it done. Come on, what's your problem? Get on with it. So I think the lack of sleep is maybe a little bit more direct.
Oh, man.
Probably the best way to put it.
So identify with you, brother. Yeah, what else do you like to do, Joe, when you're not working?
So I've got a little dog called Little Dude, who, if you follow me on Instagram, he's the focus on my Instagram. We love to go running. We love to go cycling. So let's spend a lot of time hanging out with him. I'd like to restore old bicycles and hi-fi equipment, basically technology that's seemingly but past its best. And I like to bring it back and keep it going. So lots of stuff, really.
Oh, that's cool. So tell us your origin story, Joe. And I, by the way, Mr. Joe, I think that I'm going to take a guess here, go out on a limb here. Then that nickname has to do with what your kids called you when you were an elementary school teacher.
On the money, exactly right. I worked I worked teaching kids on summer school programs who come to the UK to learn English. First of all, that's my first place I started teaching. And I worked with mostly Japanese kids. And I was running a Harry Potter themed language school. And I was a teacher there. Up in Edinburgh in Scotland at the school actually where J.K. Rowling based Hogwarts upon. So we were in this wonderful old school building. Yeah, full of Japanese students who were coming to learn English in this kind of Harry Potter themed school. And it was quite relaxed and informal. So all of the teachers were known by their first names. But the Japanese students just couldn't get their head around that, the poor Japanese kids. They were like, no, we have to call you and be respectful. So they used to call me Mr. Joe. So It came from that, really, that my nickname came from the fact that all my students used to call me Mr. Joe.
Oh, very cool.
When I wasn't dressed as Harry Potter or Ron Weasley or Dumbledore or somebody else, they would name me as Mr. Joe.
So you used to dress up for the kids?
Of course, yes. Yeah, it was all part of the fun, really.
That's awesome. You seem like you were an awesome school teacher, and now you are an awesome teacher of psychology as it relates to UX, and I think that's fascinating. I can't wait to get more in the weeds on that, but what inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
So I studied neuroscience at university first time round, back when you're 18 and you've got no idea really what to do with your life. You know, I think, oh, I'll go to university. And I had the choice of computer science or neuroscience. And I looked at the sort of demographic breakdown of computer science students and just saw basically it was like 98% men. And I looked at neuroscience and saw it was kind of 50-50 men and women. And it was a much smaller school, you know, much smaller class size. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to go for neuroscience. Without really thinking about what I was going to be doing afterwards. And so I did that for three years. And then after that, I was like, well, what do I do with my life? I need to figure out what it is. So I thought I'll go and be a teacher for a few years, hence the Japanese students. So I went and became a teacher for about 5 years, it was in the end. And then I was living abroad for quite a lot of that time. So I do a big part of what I do now is international UX, which is related to the fact that I've spent a lot of time working with international students and also living abroad. And so from that, I kind of was, you know, a bit, wasn't really enjoying, I was missing my family, wanted to come back to the UK and thought, well, I can't really be an English teacher to students of other languages in the UK very well. So I need to basically retrain. So I looked at what options were out there for me. And I, you know, I built my first website at university back in 1997. So I enjoyed the internet and kind of kept up with it. So I thought, how do I combine effectively psychology or neuropsychology and computer science? And I found a master's program in human computer interaction. And that was 2003. And yeah, I applied for it and they were like, great, you know, you've got experience of working with people, you've got psychology experience, you're interested in computers, come and join this course. So I did a master's in human computer interaction, Bath University, 2003, and basically came out off that master's program into work and haven't really looked back since.
That's awesome. So I'm curious. And I was going to ask you this question because I started reading your book. I did finish the book, which was awesome, by the way. And I was like,
I love how you insert your sense of humor into it as well. Like the first few pages, you mentioned about how your mom had suggested, and there's a whole backstory there to your mom being a big influence on you pursuing psychology and having some very differing points of view on which is the right kind of theory to apply to certain scenarios, right? So yeah. I found it was really funny how you said that. You said that if you buy me a drink, I'll tell you a story sometime about something that happened with a book your mom suggested, How to Read People Like a Book. And now I can't buy you a drink. Mr. Right. Joe, but I'd love to hear that story. I know our listeners would love to hear it too, if you don't mind.
Of course. So my mother is a psychologist. So imagine growing up with a mum who's a psychologist. lots of IQ tests, lots of thoughtful looks when I do certain bits of behavior.
She had you figured out, right?
Oh, completely. Most mothers do with their sons, but she really did. She had me completely figured out and could explain it to me in psychological theory, but she was a social psychologist. And so me going to study neuroscience at university was a little bit of a rebellious move against my mother in lots of ways, because, neuroscience is very cognitive and very heavily scientific. And so it's the kind of opposite extreme of social psychology. And so, part of my interest in psychology was I discovered a book on my mother's bookshelf when I was about 15, which was How to Read a Person Like a Book, which is effectively a guide to body language. Uh-huh. And as a 15-year-old boy, you just, imagine finding this guide to body language. Suddenly you're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. Suddenly I've got a manual for how people are thinking. And, I was discovering girls for the first time at that point. So I was like, oh, great, I could just read this book. And, getting a girlfriend's going to be really easy. So I just, it was the most awkward time trying to apply this awful psychology theory, constantly reading people's body language whilst talking to these girls and getting myself into a real pickle, trying to figure out what these girls were actually thinking and feeling towards me. And it just made the whole thing really awkward, because, again, I was also focusing on my own body language and trying to be as relaxed as possible. When you try and be relaxed in your body language, obviously you just can't, because it just makes you more uptight. So, it was just the worst. It just made me worse than it would have been if I'd just been, just naturally, just a sweet 15-year-old guy rather than 15-year-old guy with his manual as how people work. So it didn't work out. And that was my first application of psychology in to the real world. So it kind of taught me a lot about how to apply psychology to real world situations, and how you read a psychology paper or psychology theory, and then you go and apply that to the real world, and how that never really works out exactly the way you'd like it to.
Oh, that's hilarious, man. I love that story. What was your best pickup line as you were psychoanalyzing these girls?
That was the problem. I'd just be analyzing their body language, trying to figure out what they're thinking and how they're feeling, and just trying to get them to be open and more. And of course, they were, as awkward about being around members of the opposite sex as I was. So it just was just utterly awkward, because, when you're not feeling confident, your body language is all over the place. So
my eyes are up here.
No success. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, that's great. So that's so cool, man. It sounds like your mom was just a huge influence on you. And is she still here? Is she still with us?
Yeah, she's great. So my mom is a psychologist. My dad was an architect. So that was a kind of a perfect combination of parents to bring somebody kind of user experience design. So on the one hand, I had my dad always going on about how it was important to design for people, because that's all he ever talked about with architecture, people using his buildings. And my mother, and as a psychologist. So actually, at the time when you're, that young, you have no real appreciation of how great your parents are. But only sort of looking back on it was just how much of an influence both of them were from their very, seemingly at the time, very different worlds, but actually the reality is that I've kind of met them somewhere in the middle, really.
That's awesome. You made me think of a quote, and I'd like to share it, because it's so fascinating that your dad was an architect and that your mom was a psychologist. And there's both of those fields are so closely related to how we design experiences for people now, for digital experiences. And it's a quote, ironically, and maybe surprisingly, by Gary Vaynerchuk. So he's like, really, he's not a designer. He's an entrepreneur. But I love what he said in one of his books. He said, dig deeper into your craft. You want to make sure that you're equally an architect and a mason. You've got to be able to simultaneously think at a high level and get your hands dirty. How about that?
Like that.
Isn't that interesting?
That's a really nice quote, isn't it? Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, so I just thought I'd share that, but that's so cool, man. This is, speaking about superheroes, I know your mom certainly is a superhero to you. Who's been the biggest one in your work and why?
It's a good, actually. I mean, for me, I was very lucky early on that, I mean, I got into user experience sort of about 13 years ago before, you know, back when it was a very nascent field called usability back then. And
right.
One of the people I worked with initially was a kind of classic old school consultant, you know, of the management consultant class, a guy called Lawrence Clark, who was in his, in his time in the 50s. And he's just, you know, still a good friend. And what was interesting about him is he, you know, I was going back in my first job, how important usability was and how important it was to put the user at the center of everything you did, and just going on about all of this sort of stuff that, you know, we all know to be true within the user experience world. But he, you know, what he taught me was, is he basically said, look, talking about the user and the user's needs is only ever going to get you so far in your career. It'll only get you to a point where other people, you know, with other people who really care about what users want and need. And the superpower you need to effectively get is to understand how business works. Mm. And he spent a lot of time working with me. You know, I was only sort of 25, 26, teaching me how business worked and how organizations make money and how organizations measure their success and how organizational structures work and how all of that stuff was. And that those superpowers, honestly, have stuck with me more than anything else. And the stuff that I find, and the biggest problems I find with getting work done in user experience, is because, not because, you know what you should be doing, because again, you know what your user wants and they're often very good at telling you. It's just being able to make the organization you're working with make the right decision and to follow the advice you're giving them and to do what's best for users. So if you don't know enough about business and you can't, you know, you can't frame your user requirements in terms of business requirements, you're not going to be very successful. You're really not. People will not listen to the work you want. They will not, your stuff will never see the light of day. The more you talk about business and understand how business works, the more successful you're going to be as a user experience person. And Lawrence Clark taught me that at a very early age. And I think that has stuck with me more than anything else. And, you know, it's I think one of the pillars of my, you know, the reason that I am still doing what I'm doing now is that I do understand how businesses work.
That is so good. And defenders listening, Joe just dropped some major value bombs about how we can succeed as designers, especially in this day and age. Now, what you're saying, Joe, I mean, you had the benefit of, first of all, diving into a field that was completely new at the time that you started, yeah. and really largely unknown. And a lot of us, for myself, I'll speak for myself, but I know a lot identify, it took us a good maybe decade plus to start realizing that really we need to know business as designers.
Definitely.
We have to know business, right? So I think that is just a huge, huge takeaway for all of us to really let marinate and think about. And also pursue, what does that mean? Like, how do I get better at business, right? Like, and do you have some advice on that, Joe? How do we get better, as designers, get better at learning and understanding business?
I mean, for me, it was about understanding how the organization measures what it does. So although I talk about business, this is equally true of government organizations, of charities, of educational organizations. It's what are they and how do they measure and value the success of their business? What are the things that they put in their annual report that says, this is the stuff that we value? What the things that, and the best way to do it, and certainly the lot that I do, is just to spend time with senior executives and just ask them the question, you know, what is it that, you know, what is it that makes this business successful? What is it that you are measuring? What is it that you're doing? And just talk to people within the organization just to get that feedback on what it is that works for them.
That's great.
That's
advice.
Basically how I was introduced to it. It's just to talk about it. It's to talk about it with the people who know. So rather than, I mean, you can go and read books and blog posts, but the best people to speak to are business executives themselves, because they'll be able to tell you that. That's what they spend their time measuring in spreadsheets. That's what they spend their time talking about in meetings. That's what they spend, you know, that's what they build PowerPoints about, is how to effectively build a successful business. And they will tell you what that means. And I was very lucky in that the first job I had was for a consultancy. So I got to experience lots of different businesses over the first couple of years of my career. So, you know, a variety of different types. And it was fortunate enough with Lawrence, my mentor at the time, to sort of sit there while he asked questions like, how is your organization makes money? What are the 5 metrics that you measure success of this company? And he had like a standard set of sort of 3 or 4 questions he would just ask an executive, and they would give you all of those answers about effectively how to make the project you're working on a success, how to gather the right requirements from your users to get them to match the business goals the business have. So if you've got the business goals before you've got user goals, it means you can then go out and understand what your users want and then sort of put the two together, basically.
Such great advice, Joe. And I was thinking too, when you said about just go and talk to the executives. Like, I love that advice. And the reason I do love that, there's two reasons. One, we don't often do that. but also the main reason I think that's really awesome is that you're getting yourself in front of the person that's leading the organization or the people mm-hmm. that are leading the organization. And you're actually, you're getting visibility. You're showing them that you are interested in the business succeeding. I mean, that can only help you definitely. In your role, right? Like, well, the executive would be absolutely. Like, wow, this person like really cares about what we're doing here and wants to affect change. So I think that's incredible advice. That's awesome.
And also part of it, and also the person to speak to and spend time with, if you can do it, depending on how big your organization is the sort of the finance director, the chief financial officer, because they're often more typically than not the person that says no when a project gets put in front of them. You know, a project comes in and says, oh, you know, we've got these amazing user requirements to do this, and it's going to cost $1 million. The financial officer is going to go, well, what's your return on investment on this $1 million I'm spending with you? That's the first question any financial person's ever going to ever ask you for this outlay that you want to spend. And spending time before that proposal or before that meeting or before that time you're going to ask for money to get something done with the financial director saying, hey, can you help me put a business plan together to justify why we want to do this stuff? And he'll help you with those numbers. And they're often so helpful at going and getting intelligence from the business about how to effectively get the business metrics to align with your user requirements. They're great at that. And also, if you get them on side by effectively asking them to help you, when you're then presenting this stuff back to them at a later date, they can hardly say no because they've helped you put it together. Mm. And so they'll have voiced all of their concerns to you over that coffee in the cafeteria beforehand, and you'll have worked with them to sort of overcome them so that effectively you stop getting shut down because you're spending too much money, which is often the biggest reason that product teams fail is they are spending an awful lot of money without being able to justify any returns, at a point where the business can needs them effectively.
Yes, so good. That sounds like a great recipe for success right there, Joe. And I do like to kind of switch gears here, and I always like to talk about failure because failure is learning, right? I like to start this section by just saying, you know, like every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that leads to transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. And you've certainly done that, Mr. Joe, but I know that there's been certain times in your career where you've had to fail to learn a significant lesson, right? And I'm just curious, can you tell us a story perhaps of what's been the biggest one?
Yeah, so I went through quite a period of failure, and I called it at one point the curse of Joe. So any project that I worked on, I worked for quite a big prestigious design agency, working with some great clients. You know, you mentioned some of them at the start. So I've worked with eBay, with Microsoft, with Disney, with people like that. And there was a period of about 18 months where any project I worked on got canned. Mm. I'd do all this great work and it would just, for whatever reason, just never see the light of day. And it got ridiculous to the point where it was just pretty much every project was just destined to never see the light of day. You know, we put a lot of huge amount of effort in going to user research, putting business cases together, doing this design work, and it just wouldn't see the light of day. And it got me thinking. I was thinking, well, what is it? Is it me? And you know, it turns out that it wasn't me directly, but it certainly was the way that I was behaving on projects meant that stuff wasn't getting done. And the thing that I found was that actually the stuff that I think was missing from a lot of the work that I was doing was with any project, you effectively need a subset of elements within it. So to make a project successful, so you need really something that's, number one, we talked about it, going to affect the bottom line of a company.
Right.
That has to be in any project to get it greenlit by a company. It has to affect the bottom line somewhere. It's either got to save money or make money effectively for the organization. And number two, it's got to have something in there that's a bit cool and a bit exciting and a bit sexy. Because again, some people within the organization are motivated by money, and some people are motivated by innovation or excitement or doing cool things or being able to show their friend in the pub on their iPad the latest cool thing that organization has done. And then the third thing you've got to include as part of that is something that's going to meet your customer customers' needs that's going to make your customers happy. And the thing I realized looking back on my kind of Curse of Joe time is that I was missing at least one of those elements on every single project. So I was either missing the business stuff, which we've discussed, or you're missing something that was cool and exciting and innovative that people were proud of, that we could kind of stand up in a meeting and go, look, we're building one of these exciting widget thingies. Aren't we all exciting? And it looks cool and it does this and it's whiz bang and it's got this in it. And then number three, we had to have something in there that was going to make our users happy, make our customers happy. And if a project hasn't got those three things in there, then it's more likely to get canned. You know, obviously we talked about business case, but there's nothing exciting or cool. Even if it's, say, you know, spending $1 million, it's going to make $2 million. If there's nothing whiz bang or something that people can't put in a presentation or show to their buddy on an iPad, or there's nothing that tangible that looks exciting or feels exciting, the project team are either going to get bored or the executive sponsoring is going to get bored. And if, again, if there's nothing that's going to meet user needs, then we're obviously failing our customers. So all projects have to have those three things relate in them. And if you haven't got any of one of those things missing, you're more likely to be on a project that's going to fail.
There's a lot of good stuff in that answer, Joe. And I appreciate you laying the land out for that too, like, and showing us the points of why perhaps a project is not going to fly. Right. But what do you want our listeners to take away from that? Like, what did you learn from that experience?
I guess it's to cover your base, is to think about. So I think that the biggest issue we have as user experience people is not understanding what it is that our users want. I mean, we've kind of we've got the tools to do that now. We've got the job roles to do that now. Companies at least pay lip service to the fact that they want to be customer focused. We've got the ability to do that bit now. You know, the PR around UX is enough.
Right.
The thing that, you know, effectively we need to do around that is then make that into something that meets the hype that UX is giving it, really. And for me, when the reality of the hype, the reality of doesn't meet the hype, that's when things start to go wrong. So part of my career has also been is I don't talk about this very much, is I also help organizations who have got a project that's or a launch that's failed. So they've spent a lot of time and money. They've either got a great UX team or they've hired an amazing agency. They put all this money into a relaunch. They hit the relaunch go button, and the next day their numbers are down, conversions are down, users are dissatisfied, they're on the forums shouting about how awful this thing is. I often get a call on that next day saying, help, we've screwed up, because effectively you can almost do UX theater. That's fair to say. You know, you can do wireframes, you can do user research, but if you're not interpreting and understanding truly and understanding the, as I mentioned before, the business goals, the whiz bang and the user needs, those three things, you're not going to be successful. And if you meet, you know, if you're sort of mentioning meeting user goals, but you're not somehow got a business case attached to it, you're not going to be very successful. So again, I spend a lot of time picking up after internal UX teams that have launched something and it's gone wrong. Executives have lost faith in them. Agencies who've launched something with a client, something's gone wrong and their clients lost faith in them. They get me in and I help try and fix that problem quickly before that business is losing money and customers and that kind of stuff as well. And I've learned a lot from doing that. I learned a lot from failure, both mine and other people's.
Excellent. Yes, absolutely. Same here. And that's one reason why I think that's one of those questions that I ask all my guests. And it's not an easy one because it really brings a lot of vulnerability out. But there's so much value because we do learn not only from our own failures, but also from others. And again, failure is not a bad thing. It is actually learning.
Not at all.
Right.
And I think the biggest mistake a lot of project teams make, and I'd say this is definitely true of more junior and middleweight ones, is they don't expect failure. They expect, you know, if we go out and we do UX properly, we go and do some user research, we do some wireframes, we validate those wireframes, we do some designs, we validate those designs, we do an agile design process with lots of design sprints and research throughout, we're going to be successful. Mm-hmm. They just assume that if the process equals success.
Right.
And the reality, process is part of it, but you also need the experience of having been there to know what are the possibilities of what could go wrong, and planning for what can go wrong. What's going to happen when you go live and your project is not as successful as you hoped it would be? I mean, I had one this week where a project I worked on early on, you know, I set some direction for it and they dropped me a line on Monday saying, oh, we've gone live and our conversion numbers are down, help. And it's like, you need to plan for it to fail. I know that sounds like a pessimistic view, but UX can't, does not guarantee success. The UX process does not guarantee success. You've got to prepare for the fact, what happens if we launch something and it goes wrong? What are the tools and processes we've got in place to manage failure and expectation that it's going to happen? And I think that's the biggest mistake a lot of, I suppose, more junior people make when they're doing UX, is just not to expect failure.
That's awesome. Do you have, speaking of learning, and sometimes a lot of learning also happens, not sometimes, but often a lot of learning happens through user testing. I'm sure you've done your fair share of that and research. And do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened?
Yes. So I was working with a colleague, actually. This is when I was doing some stuff at eBay. And you know, the classic thing of doing a day's user research, you know, you as a moderator, you forget, you know, you are always aware that there are people watching through cameras or through that two-way mirror. You're always aware that's happening. And you're aware of the audience, but your users, you know, effectively the participants you're working with, you don't, you know, you want them to feel as relaxed as possible. So, you know, you try and do as much as you can to, you know, make them not forget, but not, you know, not be too conscious that they're being watched. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when I was working with eBay, a colleague of mine, we were doing some work on eBay fashion. So eBay were just launching this real push into clothing. And so we're interviewing lots of sort of women in their 20s. And I was working with a colleague of mine, a guy in his 20s. And he was interviewing this this young lady, and she was quite obviously flirting with him. And he was getting more and more awkward because he knew we were watching from the other room. And you know, she'd completely forgotten that, you know, because he'd said to her, you know, people are watching, she completely forgot. So she proceeded then, you know, they were talking about fashion and clothing, and she was starting to talk, sort of take it the wrong way, slightly, some of the questions he was asking her about clothing and that sort of stuff. And so she, at the end of it, she's like, so, you know, are you single at the end of the interview? And you could sort of see him, he went suddenly bright red at the end of this interview. And he was like, and she's like, you know, what are you doing after this? Do you fancy maybe going and get a drink sometime? Maybe you'd like to take my number? And we were all sort of in the next room just laughing and laughing and laughing at him. And of course he couldn't say, oh, don't forget people are watching, because he didn't want to make her feel bad about it. But it was so, so awkward, because effectively she was, you know, asking him out on a date. It was hilarious, hilarious.
Talk about a contextual inquiry.
Oh.
Yeah. Or maybe non-contextual, perhaps?
I know.
Oh, that's a great story. Joe, what's your design superpower?
Oh, that's a good question. So my design superpower is getting stuff done. So getting stuff done, getting stuff launched, getting stuff out there into the world. So
yeah,
I work more recently with lots of startups. So the power I have with them is to get them from an idea to launch really quite quickly. So making the right decisions, both from a business point of view, from a user point of view, and getting stuff done quickly. So definitely my superpower is getting the right stuff done really quickly and for the right reasons. That's certainly where I can bring value, and I bring the most value, I hope, to the stuff that I work on.
Love it. Always be shipping. And shipping the right things.
Always be shipping.
Right.
Shipping the right things. It's not just always be shipping. It's the right, shipping the right stuff. It's not the minimum viable product. It's just the right product at the right time. There's loads of stuff around that I can talk about, around startups not having very good business plans, but that's maybe a different question for
maybe
a different day.
Maybe that's another interview, another day.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
I love that's fascinating. Yeah, I love that. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for creating beautiful, interactive user experiences for websites and desktop or mobile apps. Adobe XD helps you design, prototype, and even share your experiences with your teammates and stakeholders for feedback. Try the free beta for Mac or Windows today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more. Adversely, Joe, what's your design kryptonite?
I think that maybe that's exactly that. So the organizations that I struggle to work with the most are certainly Silicon Valley startups who don't have a business plan, or their business plan is get bought by Google, Microsoft, Facebook, or somebody else. I know that I succeed in organizations that have solid business goals and that are looking to be successful and know how to be successful. And if a startup's goal is basically to be acquired, I really struggle to help that organization make the right decisions to do it, because it stops being about being a successful business or a successful startup or meeting user needs. It starts to be about how can we raise, you know, how can we look attractive to a big Silicon Valley company. And definitely that's my kryptonite, is no real business plan. It scares me, in fact, when I come across organizations that don't have them.
Right.
Startups initially. So I don't work with startups that don't have them, or unless they want me to help them get them, build one. But no, that's definitely my design kryptonite is exit strategy being bought by Facebook. Definitely.
Yeah. And you really spelled it out earlier too, when you touched on those, the business, knowing the business and such. And I'm so glad you did that. And again, there's so much takeaway for all of us, but I think about how much money is being wasted, right? When the wrong things are being built, and you just think, I mean, and I think the bigger issue here is people's jobs in many ways, right? Because if we're wasting money building the wrong things and we don't have the right research, what happens is that money goes away and there's no ROI, like you said, and guess who suffers? The people, their jobs. It's scary. It can be very so scary true. To build the wrong thing, right?
And you know, and my advice to anybody out there, if you're looking to take a job with a startup, ask that question in the interview. What is your business plan? How are you looking to make money? And if their business plan is to get bought by somebody like Facebook or Instagram or somebody, you know, or Facebook or Google or somebody like that, just be careful, because there's the unicorns that get that, there's billion-dollar companies that get bought by people like that. They're so far, few and far between. And that's a risk, but at least go into that risk with your eyes open, you know, knowing that you could, you know, be a multimillionaire if it goes the right way. But yeah, there's 99.99% chance that you're going to be out of a job within a year when they run out of runway because they've got no business plan, or, you know, they're already on their second pivot. So any organization that's on this, startups on their second pivot or even their first pivot, just be careful, because if they haven't got that kind of clarity of vision and direction, the chances are they're not going to be particularly successful. So always ask that question in the job interview, you know, what is your exit plan? You know, have you got a business plan? Can you talk it through with me? And then you'll know. If it's so you don't get yourself into that position, because it's such a shame that people do.
Yeah, that is great advice. Nice. Great, great advice. So I'm gonna go ahead and commit a cardinal sin here of user interviews. I'm gonna bias you by saying I would venture that maybe your answer is Mr. Joe, but what would your UX superhero name be?
Well, it's not particularly undercover, is it? So it's like Clark Kent putting on glasses and becoming, you know, Superman putting on glasses and becoming Clark Kent. What would my Superman? What is it? It starts to get, I end up sounding a bit boring, like business guy, but then that presupposes my uniform is like some sort of suit when it's really, really not. I suppose psychology guy just makes me sound a bit creepy. So it's like, it's quite a hard one to be, really, is to say, what is my superhero name? Yeah, go on. I like Mr. Joe. Mr. Joe's got to be my superhero name, definitely.
That works.
Or maybe Mr. J if I'm undercover, something like that.
Okay.
They don't really know it's me.
Right on. No, that's great. And again, I had a feeling, but I and that's why I kind of put my little bias in there. But yeah, that's cool. It's funny you mentioned Superman too. I when you think about superheroes, and which I'm obviously very inspired by and I've been for a long time. It's funny how Superman is one of the only heroes that has to put on a costume to be normal, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? The other ones, he's like, everyone else is kind of the opposite way. But he has to like put on a costume to really be a normal guy, because he's just so powerful. But I don't know where I was going with that, but I always thought that was really fascinating.
Do you know what? It's true, actually. I meet a lot of, this is something else to be wary of as well. So I meet a lot of, because I spend a lot of time, with C-level executives. I spend a lot of time with them, and I find that they're often the same way. They spend and they put all of their, so one of the big things that I chose to do with my life was that I only work 4 days a week, and I am very strict on my work day. I don't really work more than sort of 7 hours a day, because for me it's something that's really, really important, because what can end up happening is your job becomes start to define who you are, and you end up like that. So you end up on that Saturday morning, you know, your dress down is like you don't wear a tie, you're wearing the same shirt you wear, it's tucked into your slacks, and you've got your brown work shoes on, because you haven't got clothes that are, you know, civilian clothes anymore. Is that you've got to be really careful of not working too hard and your job defining you, and you wake up suddenly one day and you're 50 and, you know, you find yourself just wearing the same clothes that you wore to work the day before, just with no tie. And that's the last place anybody really wants to be. So there is definitely something to be said about your Superman analogy there.
Yeah.
Certainly, Jason.
I love that. And I envy you, my friend, but I think it's a testament to your GSD, you know, get stuff done philosophy. I don't think we need, I think 8 hours a day was a myth. I think it's something that Rockefeller came up with the factories, right? Everyone's got manual labor.
It's a Victorian.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you know, because I know the study that was done. So it was done by Victorians, by Victorian factory owners, and they wanted an efficiency study. And it's part of this whole thing called the Hawthorne effect, which is interesting. So the Hawthorne effect is this this study that was done in the 1920s. It's a time and motion study related to luminosity, so the lights in a factory. Mm. And they did the study where they sort of, you know, they got these scientists in white coats with clipboards to measure productivity of factory workers at 100% at different light levels. So they did the baseline at 100% luminosity. You know, they sort of noted down how productive people were. They then reduced the lights to 80% and noted down productivity, 60%. And they didn't see any reduction in productivity. They kept lowering the lights down to 40%. Still no reduction in productivity. They got the lights down to about 6% luminosity, and productivity was still at this notional 100%. And the reality was, is the reason that, you know, productivity was that high was because there were men in white coats with clipboards watching factory workers work. It was nothing to do with the lights. And I think a lot of work time is based upon these outdated modal theories of, you know, a scientist watching you with a clipboard to see how productive you are. 8 hours is nowhere near the most productive amount of time you can work.
Mm, absolutely. And I'm going to tell this story real quick that's related. And I've told it before. I believe it was on Nikhil Blaze's episode, but it's about Henry Ford. Mm. And you probably know the story, Joe. Henry Ford once hired an efficiency expert to go through his plant to find the unproductive workers. The expert made the rounds with his clipboard in hand, and he finally returned to Ford's office with his report. And he said, "I found a problem with one of your administrators," he said. "Every time I walk by, he was sitting with his feet propped up on the desk, and the man never does a thing. I definitely think you should consider getting rid of him. Fire the guy," right? And when he learned of the name, when Henry Ford learned the name of the man the expert was referring to, Ford shook his head and said that that man had once come up with an idea that saved the company millions, and that he'd thought of it with his feet in the same position.
There we go.
I love that, right?
Exactly.
Like, what did you call it?
I get it.
You call it procrastinating. I call it thinking. Aaron Sorkin says that.
Absolutely. Anyway. So true.
Yeah. Love that. So I'd like to ask you, one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
I think I fight for my users by framing their requests in terms of, or their needs in terms of either psychology or business or something that gives them or amplifies their voice into something stronger. So a user saying, "Oh, I find this difficult to use," or "I wouldn't use this thing," is only a step in the right direction to fixing and dealing with that problem. They need their needs amplified by either business, which we talked about a lot, or psychology. So some justification for why that person is saying what they're saying, and some effective way of fixing that on a larger scale. So I think definitely I fight for superheroes for users by amplifying their needs so loud into something that's so loud that businesses can't say no.
That's so good. Yes, definitely identify the user's needs and then justify the business need and build something cool. Right?
Yeah, completely.
I think maybe in that order. I want to talk about psychology and design. And this is your wheelhouse. And I would feel remiss. And I think my listeners, our defenders, would want to punch me if I didn't try to dig a little deeper into the correlation between psychology and design. What is that? What is the correlation, Joe, between psychology and design?
Okay, I'll let you all into a little secret here. You could buy my book and you'd maybe figure this out, but I'm just going to tell you the secret anyway.
Definitely buy the book, Defenders. Definitely. It's really great.
It's only a few pounds. It's quite cheap anyway. But anyway, the key with using psychology is psychology helps you frame what you're seeing in user research. So it helps you effectively describe at a higher level what you're seeing and what your users are doing on one hand. So, you know, 50% of it is it describes existing user behavior. The challenging and most useful part of psychology is the other 50%, which is effectively prescribing what would happen in a given situation. So using psychology to say, if all these variables are in line, this is what will happen at the end. So a good example is that an experiment was done in a cafeteria where they had an honesty box. So people would come in and they would take tea or coffee, in this case milk, and they would pay, you know, a few pence, dollars, and be honest about what, how much coffee or tea or milk they drank. And so these psychologists had this idea that they would, on this honesty box, they would try a number of different images to see if an image would make people more honest or not. And they tried a number of them, and the one that ended up working was a pair of eyes looking straight at that person. So when that image was placed upon the honesty box, people were honest, and the amount of money they gave for their tea and coffee and milk went up. And this is a classic example of prescriptive psychology. So it describes the fact that if you want your users to be more honest, so I've used this in, so I've worked for health insurance companies, and health insurance companies classically ask the question, have you smoked a cigarette in the last 2 years? And most people will know that when they are on a health insurance website, and if they answer yes to that, they know their premium is going to go up, right? Classic. So I've worked with health insurance companies to make it so people are a bit more honest, because, you know, we want people who smoke to pay higher premiums, because if people lie on their health insurance policy, it means all of our health insurance policies go up, because effectively they can't spot the difference between a smoker and a not. So I've worked with a health insurance company to do that, to put a picture of, in fact, this was the celebrity who backed their, had the TV advertising for this health insurance, put them on the page next to this particular question, looking at them in a stern manner. And we spotted a marked increase in the amount of people that answered honestly to that question, said, yes, I have smoked a cigarette in the last 2 years. And that's the other half of it. So the other 50% of psychology is prescriptive, is saying, if we do this thing, then this behavior will happen. And so my book is all about how you uncover the prescriptive psychology. How do you uncover the psychology that's going to tell you, if you do something, then this thing will most likely happen? But if you heard my introduction earlier on about the body language book, How to Read a Person Like a Book, that's classic prescriptive psychology. And that taught me an important lesson back when I was 15, that actually, do you know what? However well it's studied within psychology theory, however much evidence there is to point out that if you do something like, you know, like this, then this will happen, the reality is that's never the case. And so psychology could be great to give you ideas about how to nudge people in a certain direction, but you can't 100% guarantee that it's going to work, because we are complicated people, because psychology isn't a refined science like physics. There isn't a definitive yes or no answer. So I talk a lot about in my book about how to find and assess psychology to know if it's going to be successful or not. How do you know the good psychology from the bad psychology? How do you know what psychology is going to work in which situation and why? And I do my best in my book to help you, give you a framework to figure that sort of stuff out.
Awesome. Yeah, I love the idea of predictive behavior too, and I think that's a huge takeaway for all of us, especially as we're in design and we're trying to design solutions. So I feel like the predictive part of that is truly valuable, because we are trying to get users to do something. We're trying to get them to we're trying to guide them, and that's up to us. Right. I mean, first of all, we identify the problems they're having, but then we have to give them an interface. We have to give them something, a solution to solve that problem. And I think that for me, the takeaway is that the more we understand people and the more we understand behavior, I think that the better and more optimal and effective our designs are going to be. And I kind of thought about it. I don't know if this is the best analogy or not, but I kind of thought about it in this way, like, not understanding, not taking the time to really understand people and understand behaviors and mental models. Not understanding, it's like playing a slot machine with your design. Like you put the quarter in and you pull the handle and you just hope. You hope something sticks, right? You hope you get the three cherries or whatever it is. But on the other hand, kind of understanding, understanding people and understanding psychology theory, I think it's almost like, you remember in Back to the Future? You remember whenever he went into the future and he found out who won the World Series, and then he went back and bet on it? It's kind of like that. Like it's more of a sure bet, right? I mean, you can never be completely 100% sure when you're dealing with people, because everyone's so different, but you certainly get a lot better odds, don't you?
It's so true. It's like, I always say that a designer who doesn't understand psychology is going to be no more successful than an architect who doesn't understand physics. You need to know the building blocks of the medium you're working in. And if you don't understand that, and in architecture, it's classically, it's engineering, it's physics, you need to know if your building is going to fall down or not. If you don't know enough about how people think and behave and feel, you're not going to be a successful designer, because that's ultimately the medium you're working in. You're not working in the medium of Photoshop or Sketch or OmniGraph or anything like that. You're working in the medium of communication and people and society. And if you don't understand that at a fundamental level, you're not going to be a successful designer. You're really not.
Oh, so good.
Hi, I'm David Demery. I'm a product manager for Adobe Typekit. I'd fight for the users, and you're listening to the User Defenders podcast with Jason Ogle.
Let's wrap up the show, Joe. I hate to, but I have to. Let's wrap up the show.
It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, man, this is awesome. With imparting of superpowers. Now, what's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
I guess it's having a number of tools in my toolbox and knowing which tool to use at any one time. So I've talked about a few of them actually today. I've talked about business. I've talked about psychology. I've talked about whiz bang and innovation.
Yep.
Is that you... as a UXer, I've got to decide which of those methods of almost, I suppose, advocacy of your ideas is going to be the most successful. So I've got a conference talk on this, which you could link about, which is called How to Design with Science. But effectively, it's that idea that you need to decide which of, you've got a great design idea, and great design idea is only 50% of the problem solved. You've got to be able to advocate that design idea to the wider project team that you're working with. And so I use a number of different tools. I might use business, I might use psychology, I might use use a story of how a user's done something, emotional things. I might use innovation and blue sky thinking. But whatever it is, I'm very, very clear on that tool that I use to get that job done, to get that piece of design work launched, to convince the team that this is a good idea. And it's the skill I'll impart is understanding and having a different set of tools for different individuals that you're working with, understanding which buttons will work. You know, if you're working with a finance guy, absolutely business is going to work. If you're working with a empathetic communicator, then stories of what users are doing is going to work. If you're working with a data guy, then psychology might work. But you need to know and be able to pick a tool from your toolbox that's going to help you advocate the design change that you know is important to meet user needs. And if you don't choose the right tool, you're not going to be very successful.
That's a perfect segue into my next question. And you may have answered it already, but what's your most invincible tool that you can recommend to our listeners?
Most invincible tool. I mean, it sounds harsh. I can't believe I'm saying this. Or resource, no. But for me, I can't, because again, if you'd asked me this 10 years ago, I'd have hated my future self for this. My most invincible, I think the most useful tool in any UX's or product manager's arsenal is an Excel spreadsheet that shows the business case for what they're doing. That is invincible. If at the end of the day, you cannot advocate to your business how much more successful it's going to be by some sort of metric, be that money, be that happiness, be that whatever that is, it's got to be some metrics for doing that thing, you're going to be successful. Most of us, you know, unless you're working for Apple, and Apple like to do the right thing, there are very, very few businesses that are able to do that at such scale. You need to be able to advocate using, and God, I know, and I don't use it very often, but when I break out Excel, it's because, you know, I really need to get something done and really make sure I get something done. So I'd say the most invincible tool I've got is a fundamental understanding of business numbers. And I know that sounds really boring. And honestly, my 22-year-old self would call me some sort of cop-out loser business, boring business guy. You've got to fight for the good stuff. But I'm still fighting for the good stuff. I'm just using tools that already exist to help me get there.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a brilliant answer. And it's, maybe not the most sexy that you'd think, especially as designers. We all love cool things, right? We all love neat innovations. You said the whiz bang factor, and certainly that's not a bad thing. But again, you gotta start by justifying the need for business and users. And so I appreciate you reiterating that. And I really, really good.
If you think about creative directors who are parts of the work we work with, I would never go to a creative director and say, "Here's the spreadsheet to justify my latest design." He would laugh me out of the room. It's like, you've got to use certain tools for certain people. It's absolutely the case. Right. I'm not saying whiz bang and cool, exciting, innovative stuff doesn't work. It's just not going to work with all people all the time.
Right. That is awesome. So I'm going to go ahead and start this next question by highly recommending your awesome book. It's called Psychology for Designers, and Defenders, pick it up. I'll have a link in the show notes. Joe, I'll tell you, you know that quote, or that's a saying that says, teach a man to fish, right? And they never have to ask you again. And this really, you've done in this book, Joe, and it's you pack so much into it. It's a real tight read. It's a pretty quick read, but you pack so much into it. And what you did in this book is you're teaching a man to fish. You have so many resources and insights in the book that I'll tell you honestly that what this did for me is it truly inspired me to want to pursue my knowledge of psychology. I'm pumped. I want to learn more. And so that was a total success for me in this book. So I'm going to recommend that book to our listeners to pick it up. And I have a feeling they're going to be inspired as well, especially after this conversation, to want to learn more and dive deep into psychology and tie it into design. But I want to ask you, if you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
So I would recommend, it's actually two books of a series. Here we go. I'm going to break the rules right here. And now. there's a book called Business Model Generation, and its follow-up, which is called Value Proposition Design. And these are basically business books that are written for designers and for UXers. And they are a series of tools that help you understand how business works and how to apply design thinking and how to fit your design thinking into the business world. They are incredibly well-written, concise, and they're beautiful books as well. And they are absolutely wonderful. They're published by John Wiley. There's about five or six authors they're written by. But yeah, Business Model Generation and Value Proposition Design, the follow-up, are superb books in terms of justifying all your work in terms of user and business need at the same time. Great, great, great books.
Wonderful. I'll be sure to link those in the show notes as well. And so I want to say too that I think the very first book you linked to, and if I'm not mistaken, in your book is Dr. Richard Gross's Psychology. And that, I was looking at it on, I'm an iPad reader. So I typically get a lot of digital books, and I was looking at it, and you can actually download, a preview on iTunes. And the book is, I can't even, it's huge, right? I mean, there's thousands of pages,
book.
Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, there is.
In the preview, in the download, the sample, I think they give you like 700 of his pages. I think there's 700 pages in the, I'm serious. I downloaded it. I'm like, I'm curious about this now. And you can read like probably up to chapter 5 in the book. So that's a nice little tidbit there. And I got an iTunes. I think my kids are going to give me an iTunes card for my birthday coming up here next week. And so I already have $15, and I think I'll be able to actually buy, I think it's like $25 or something on iTunes. I think I'm going to buy that and start plowing through
it. Good books. Good, that one. Yeah. Lots of interesting stuff.
You think that's a great book for designers to
It's a good
into?
One. I mean, it's basically like Psychology 101 textbooks. It's quite used in quite a lot of universities, but it's very accessible. So it kind of takes you back to basics in terms of psychology. So it's not going to talk about psychology in terms of design. You've effectively got to make that leap, that connection between how does this relate to the design work I'm doing? And that's my one tip to you. If you're reading Richard Gross's book, is to at every point you're reading it going, well, how does this relate to my design work? How does this relate to the team that I work in? How does this relate to the user research I'm doing? But always try and bring it back to the work you're doing, because otherwise you can just end up getting a little lost in it, because it's huge.
That's great.
You need to keep referencing it back to the work you do. How could I apply this? How could I use this? What does this mean? And that will help you get a lot more out of that book.
Great points. So this is my last question for you, Joe, and this is one of my favorite ones. This is the reason I really get to have wonderful guests like you on the show to add so much value to our listeners. And a lot of my defenders listening are aspiring. They're just kind of diving in, getting their feet wet in the field. And I'd like to ask you, what's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes?
Is to get out the design studio and get into the rest of the business. I think my advice is to kind of just spread your wings a little bit in the organization. Just go and make friends with everybody. So you'd have probably got this advice anyway, go and make friends with developers and go and make friends with product managers, but just spread the wings even wider and go and make friends with people in the rest of the business. Go make friends with people in customer services. Go and just get out there and just build contacts throughout the organization. The most successful UX people I know within business, within organizations, have got links to every other part of that organization. They know somebody in a different team. They're getting inputs from left, right, and center. Is you need to be that person that links the business together. You need to be the person who's out there effectively speaking to customers, but then coming back with those customer needs in terms of, well, how do we, because again, a lot of the work we do in user research, you know, user experience design is, if you put a, you know, if you change a button on a website that says, you know, free, you know, our user feedback said that users want free next day delivery. And you come back to the business and say, hey, business, all our users have said to us, all of them, we want free next day delivery. They'll laugh you out of the room because that's going to be an enormous cost to them. Right. Huge cost to the whole business to say that. Is you need to be able to go and justify that particular thing you've heard from users in terms of the business. You need to go out and chat to somebody about what that means and then say, hey, I heard from users that they want a free next day delivery. I've spoken to Bob in operations and he says, if we do this, this and this, we could do that for this, this and this. Is you need to start taking those user requirements, and before you even communicate them, is to go and gather more business requirements or rest of the organization requirements to meet up with them to go and take that forward.
Oh, man. Awesome stuff, Joe.
Thank you.
This is a truly wonderful interview and so much value. As we close, I want to ask you, what's the best way for our audience to connect and to keep up with you?
So Twitter, if you use Twitter, I share loads of articles on Twitter about psychology and UX and product and business. So I'm at Mr. Joe, MRJOE. I joined Twitter really early, like 2006. So I managed to get a great username.
Yeah, it is.
And also my website. I also publish loads of articles. I publish something every week. And that's Mr. Joe, MRJOE.UK. I've just actually published a series of UX mistakes that I've made. So I'm just about to publish another one tomorrow, which is the, I think, fourth or fifth in the series of UX mistakes I've made. And it's great if you're an aspiring UXer because you can learn from the stuff that I've messed up. I've also written loads of stuff on business and psychology, but MrJoe.UK is the best place to go for my writing, or at Mr. Joe, find me on Twitter. And I share my writing as well as other people's stuff as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being here, Joe. And
thank you, Jay.
This has been so awesome, as I just mentioned, and I can't wait to share this episode with our listeners. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Oh, yes. Keep fighting the good fight.
Designers learn business. Mic drop. That was such a valuable lesson from Joe. I'm so glad he spent time elaborating upon that and why that's important as designers. And we all want the whiz bang. I love that too. But we must first determine user needs and business case. That's where it all begins. So I just love that, especially his advice about getting out of your seat, talking to executives. I mean, that was just, it just seems so obvious now, but it was such a value bomb to me because it's so easy to kind of stay in our seats, and I'm guilty myself of that. So I think it was just a really good takeaway. Just to, if there's an opportunity to connect with your executive, or make that opportunity if you're so bold, and see if you can get a coffee or even just meet for a few minutes in their office and talk about the business model. Talk about how you can add value to that in your skill set. I love that. So that was just huge for me, huge takeaway, and I hope for you too. So also, I just want to mention Joe's great book, Psychology for Designers. It's only a few pounds, as he said. I think that's about $4 in U.S. currency. So, it's a great book. It'll really open your eyes and your mind to psychological theory and how it relates to design. And again, it really does teach you how to fish and find some wonderful resources out there. Great interview. Really enjoyed my time with Joe. I want to thank Chris Combs for the extraordinary editing, Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork, and Darren Goldsmith for the sensational show notes. So anyway, thanks so much for listening, Defenders. Hope you're on the mailing list, the Biweekly Bugle. If not, please get on there. I'd love to connect with you on a more personal level. You can do so by going to userdefenders.com/join. And until next time, fight on, my friends.